Investing Simplified is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisory firm. Price Financial Group has been doing estate planning since 1970 and investment and retirement planning since 1975. Individual situations may vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial program with a certified financial planner, estate planning attorney, and a certified public accountant to answer your questions for free. Got a tough estate, tax, or financial problem keeping you up at night? You can call the show right now at 503-222-9700. That's 503-222-9700. Long distance and podcast listeners can call toll free at 800-344-5836. Coming to you live from Portland, Oregon, and broadcast on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Bo Caldwell.
We do Investing Simplified.
Hello and welcome into Investing Simplified. However you're joining us today, thank you for making us a part of your day, of your week, of your weekend, especially on this, the holidays of holiday weekend, the Valentine's weekend. So for those folks out there who have a Valentine and may have felt the pressure this weekend to do something special, we appreciate you taking time away from your romantic getaway or different thing to listen to us. Talk today. In studio with me is Kevin Stagia Baker Colson. Hello, Kevin.
Howdy, Bo. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. That brings up a point. I've had some people ask questions, some folks wondering, and Chuck has, I've gotten the official committal in writing. Well, I mean, it's email, but in writing.
Yeah.
That he's going to come on sometime next month. So he said just, he needs you to be here, he said.
He'll bring his oversized soapbox and bring it on in.
Yeah,
and
so we'll keep everyone posted when Chuck makes his return.
Sounds good.
He'd like to call his segment the Geezer Report, is what he said.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty Chuck, too, right? And I said, well, all right, if that's what you we could work with that title for now. But yeah, no, because people have been asking. I know folks miss hearing from him, and so he has said, he's committed at least in email form.
He'll have the sound of a golf ball off a driver in the background or something as part of his theme.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. We'll have to get to work on that for sure. I tell you, it's been a pretty, it's a pretty crazy start to this year in the market. So a lot of people are always asking about, what my thoughts are for the market, what my projections are for the market, my forecasting. And it's just kind of funny. Forecasting is relatively useless. I mean, it's fun to talk about what we think is going to happen. I can tell you what I think is going to happen. But, interestingly enough, a statistic that I was looking at the other day, and I shared this last week with Michael, but I heard an adage, and I don't know who it's ascribed to, but there are three types of lies in this world. There's lies, darn lies, but a different way of saying darn, and then statistics. Those are the
there we go.
And so but an interesting statistic that I heard, and you kind of looked at the projections when we're talking about forecasting, but kind of remember back to December of 2018, so a little over a year ago, when the market had taken just a giant tumble over the course of a couple months. We actually in the middle of the day, intraday, touched down 20%. So the market from all-time highs was down 20% from its all-time high at one point during the day, and it closed at down 19. So we didn't hit a bear market, but hit just about, and depending on who you're talking to. But at that point, they got together a bunch of, people who are economists, people who forecast, really smart people, much smarter than I, much smart, really know what they're talking about and have a lot of experience in the industry. And, it was CNBC folks, Fox Business folks, Bloomberg, and there's all the different people that do these charts and stuff. And they said, okay, right now, based on where the 10-year treasury is, where do you think interest rates are going to go? Since then, do you know what interest rates have done since December of 2018?
Gone down.
They've gone down. In fact, yes, correct. How many of those super smart people that get paid to postulate on what's going to happen in the market, and it was people that manage people's money and all those people that had these super brilliant forecasts, how many of those people thought the interest rates would be down?
Zero.
Zero. And only one had a slight downward movement in his projections. All the rest of them thought up, 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 and we'd be up over 4% by now. Right? So, and yep. that's yep. logical. You thought that there's no way interest rates could get lower at that point, right? They thought, you know. So, my point is, when you're trying to project or trying to forecast what's going to happen in the market, it's, you know, it's a fool's errand. What is it? I think Yogi Berra said, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. So the idea is that we might be able to project forward what may happen. We can look at what has happened, drive through the rearview mirror and say, well, when this happened last time, this is what happens going forward. The only key is to really have a strategy, have an investment plan, have a focus in what you're doing with your investments. If you're having about, if you're talking about market exposed investments that are going to do what you need them to do over time, no matter what the market actually does. And that involves diversification, which is a conversation that I've had a couple of times in the last couple of months, the difference between diversification and just returns that you think you're going to get comparing yourself to the S&P 500, which is what most people do, which is truly not a diversified asset class, right? It's just large cap, which for those folks that don't know, capitalization is the measurement of how big a company is. And the way that market capitalization is measured is you take the number of shares outstanding in that company multiplied by the price of those shares, and that's your overall market capitalization. The S&P 500 is the 500 biggest stocks by market capitalization in the U.S. economy. So it's large cap U.S. equities. So when you're comparing yourself to large cap U.S. equities in terms of your overall portfolio, it's not really a fair comparison both ways. So when the market, the S&P 500 is just going straight up, or it's gone up, you know, a little over 4% so far this year, and you compare yourself to that and say, well, my 401k, I'm not doing as well as that. But are you just in the S&P 500, or do you have a little international in there? Do you have a target date fund that might have some bond exposure for safety? Do you have a broadly diversified portfolio, in which case that portfolio is not necessarily going to beat the S&P 500 all the time, and it shouldn't be your goal. Your goal should be, what returns do I need to get on average over time as I'm saving, as I'm building up? What do I need to get to my financial goal? And maybe that's retirement. Maybe that's college planning. Maybe that's buying a home. Maybe that's buying a second home, moving to a retirement community. Whatever that goal is, if you have a specified set of goals, then when you built out, I need to do certain things to get there, then you can be careful of that FOMO, right? The fear of missing out. Where a lot of times people are thinking, oh my gosh, I've missed out on amazing returns in the market. The market's been, you know, last year the S&P 500 did something like 29%, if you were just January 1 to December 31st, right? But you would have had to hold on to it through some dips and some drops, although not a lot, because last year was sort of a pretty smooth up year. But if you weren't in just that S&P 500 fund, because you can't invest directly in the index, but you know the S&P 500, that's, you know, trails it by 0.03%, then don't compare yourself to the S&P 500. Compare yourself to what you are going for. That, you know, I talk to my nine-year-old all the time about, don't compare yourself to what other people are doing. Do the best that you can do. And that's, you measure yourself by your own measuring stick, right? Rather than comparing yourself to 500 biggest stocks in the U.S. market, unless you own those 500 stocks, or you own stocks where you're thinking, I'm going to try and beat it. So you're in large cap stocks, but only picking the ones that drove it higher. And if you did, if you picked Microsoft, and if you picked Amazon, and you picked Netflix, and you picked Google, and you picked maybe Facebook, and said, I'm going to take those six stocks, you probably did better than the overall, the broad S&P 500. But if you picked the four, I don't know what the four laggards, the four worst performers are, but let's say you picked the four to six worst ones, then you might have been behind. So the big key is, instead of comparing yourself to what you see on Fox Business, CNBC, Bloomberg, whatever you tend to watch, those tickers that run across the bottom that say, hey, the S&P is up to all-time highs yet again. And you're thinking, man, you know, that market was up, you know, 29. I was only up 22. You were up 22%, right? Is that, and is that in line with what you need when you were doing your retirement plan, when you were doing your projection, your financial plan long-term? Is that within what you need to get there? If you haven't had a financial plan, if you want to see what that looks like, if you want to find out what it looks like to just put everything together, take a look at a holistic picture, you can give our office a call, 503-253-3000. The first hour is on us, so we'll get together, kind of go over a plan and show you where you're at. We talk through what you're looking to do, how to get there, some strategies that we might use. There's no obligation when people come and see me, and that's a question people get a lot. And the idea is, just like Chuck, I'd carry on that legacy of the information we want to get out there. Information is power. That's why we do this show, right? So if you want to have someone take a second look, if you want to see what a financial plan looks like, give my office a call, 503-253-3000. We can sit down with you and kind of go over that. Because the big thing is setting your own expectations, not just for me telling my clients what our expectations are, but setting them for yourself. Because if you can get to the goals that you have by saving, by getting that company match, by plugging money in every month, and if you can stay on track to get where you're going, why take more risk? Why risk being in that S&P 500 fund that, by the way, lost 52% from peak to trough, so from the top of the market to the bottom of the market back in the financial crisis? So if you have as an example, if you are getting ready to retire, you have $1 million portfolio and you've been killing it because you said, hey, I'm getting 29% in 2019. I'm getting the market returns, and that's amazing. But then you say, okay, it's time to retire, and you're still managing the money just the way that you've been managing it because we're trying to, chase returns and get the highest returns we can. Your $1 million portfolio just went down to under $500,000. Now $490,000 doesn't go nearly as far in your 20 to 30 year retirement as $1 million would. So it's important to kind of set those expectations with yourself and make sure that you're not taking too much risk. The big thing is making sure that you know what you're going for, right? I mean, if your goal is to beat the S&P 500, then by all means, go for it, and you're going to end up taking risks. And the hard part is, like I just said, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You don't know. We don't know. The most, smartest people, the people who do this for a living in terms of forecasting, they manage billions of dollars. They're wrong all the time. And we don't have a time horizon as humans like Wellington Management does when they're managing MIT's endowment fund. MIT's endowment fund is going to exist in perpetuity. So if they ride that 52% down, it doesn't matter because they have hundreds of years, ostensibly, right? They have an infinite time horizon where they can make that money back. As a human being, we don't have that infinite time horizon. And so how long do you have to make your way back from a 52% drop? So, just to start it off with, cake and pie, right? Hey, hoo-hoo, just bring the mood down. Let's talk about the coronavirus next, right? Let's talk about fun stuff. So I think that's a good place to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk some more about investing. We'll have that tax investigator segment coming on up later. But if you have a question, pick up the phone, give us a call, 503-222-9700. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Investing Simplified.
Legal matters are never easy, but they are especially difficult when they involve the most important people and aspects of your life. This is Taylor Cattell, founding partner of KG Law Group. It's important to have an attorney who cares about your unique circumstances and knows how to get the outcome that is best for you. At KG Law Group, we specialize in estate planning and family law, including wills, trusts, powers of attorney, guardianship, and divorce. At KG Law Group, we provide both expertise and compassion as we guide you through the complex legal landscape. We balance knowledge of the law with exemplary client service. Whether you are reacting to a crisis or planning for the future, we are here to help. If you need legal advice, give us a call today and schedule a consultation at 503-878-8948. That's 878-8948. Or visit us online at kglawgroup.com. That's kglawgroup.com, serving Oregon and Southwest Washington. KG Law Group, your family, your legacy.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for your phone calls. We have Steve on the line, Kevin. And Steve has a question about inheriting an annuity. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
So you had a question, Steve, about inheriting an annuity?
Yeah. I recently inherited two annuities. One is $40,200. And it has a taxable basis of $27,000. So there's a taxable income of $12,700. That just goes right on the income, your income tax, right? Your income?
Yeah, if you liquidate it, yes.
if you take it all in a lump sum.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's what I'll do on that one. The other one is a little larger. It's $90,000, and it's all taxable. Oof. And my question, I mean, that's a pretty big, you know, significant income bump to take in a lump sum.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to take that over 10 years or within 10 years, right?
On an annuity versus is it an IRA annuity or is it just a non-qualified annuity? Does that make sense? Is it an inherited? Was the annuity in an IRA before you inherited it?
It was a life insurance annuity.
Okay.
And my mother was taking the minimum distribution. She was over 70 and a half, so she was taking the required minimum distribution.
Sure. Okay. So, yeah, that sounds like it was an... It's a confusing thing where annuities can be held inside of an IRA as well. And so it sounds like that was an IRA annuity. So in which case did, and sorry to be pressing on you, but when did mom pass away and when did you inherit that?
She passed away January 20th.
Oh, okay. So yes. So if you're in, when she passed away and you're inheriting after January or December 31st, 2019, then the new 10-year rule would apply to you. Yeah. You have to take that. That's where the Secure Act switched it. So if people inherit money last year, like this time last year, anytime in 2019, then they still operate under the old rules and are grandfathered in under the lifetime payout, the required minimum payouts. But you are, yes, under the new rules of the Secure Act, you have to take it out within 10 years. But you don't have to take it out one-tenth every year. You could, if you are going to take this big income this year from the previous annuity, maybe you just want to take a part of it this year and then a part of it next year and that sort of thing.
Are you bound by the required minimum distribution then?
I don't believe so.
I think on the
you can take it all out on year 10.
Yes. You have 10 years to take it out, so you can wait till year 10. That's the difference in the new rule. The old rule used to be you had to satisfy if she passes away in a year. Now, and I don't know that I'd have to find out because the old rule was she passed away this year, and if she hadn't satisfied her RMD in the year that she passed away, under the old rule, you had to satisfy hers in that first year, and then after that, it went to be yours.
With the new rule,
I'm not certain if you still have to satisfy her RMD before the 10-year, because it's this change of the Secure Act.
Yeah,
Kevin,
I don't know, but my guess is that the RMD still needs to go out in the year of death.
That's my expectation, Steve, is that the first year you have to take whatever her RMD would have been if she didn't take it already. So if she hadn't satisfied it before she passed away, then you have to satisfy her RMD, whatever amount that was.
The first year, and then goes on the 10-year plan.
Correct. Yes, that's our belief. That's our best guess with it. That's what the old rule was, and I feel like as long as you're doing as much as what the old rule was, then they're not going to penalize you for not taking it. The big thing is, if you have an RMD, you want to take it because the penalty is 50% of whatever the amount would be, and you still have to take the RMD. So it's a nasty, nasty penalty if you don't take it. But you have till the end of this year to do that.
Yeah, got it. Okay. So what about, I mean, this can be rolled over into an IRA. I mean, I guess assuming it's a IRA annuity.
So yeah, assuming it's an IRA annuity, you can roll it into what's called a inherited IRA or a beneficiary IRA. You can't roll it into your own IRA. When you're a spouse inheriting an IRA, you can roll it into your own IRA, but a non-spouse grown person, the other qualified beneficiary is a minor child that gets to roll it into to keep that.
So
old,
I've got to open up a new IRA account, a beneficiary IRA.
Yeah, you open a benefit, assuming it's an IRA annuity.
It's there, and I have to take it over 10 years.
Yep, you got to take it out, but you could surrender the annuity, so it's no longer an annuity policy if you wanted to go invest it in market instruments or CDs or anything like that. But yeah, it'll say on the contract, on that front page, under her name, it'll say type, and it usually either says qualified plan or it'll say IRA.
Okay, I got to dig up the contract or get a lost one.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a suggestion on what to do with that money? I mean, would it be prudent to put it in a Roth conversion of that?
That's a good question. So you actually can't convert inherited IRAs to Roth. But what you could do is when you take the money, when you're taking those distributions out, so we take the money out, pay the taxes on it, and then you can turn around and do a contribution to a Roth.
Put it into a Roth account.
Yeah, it's as a contribution, but you're limited to the annual contribution limit and your income limits, which, again, if you're having to take a big 90K bump in that first year, might push you out of it, right? So that's Yeah. You're smart to spread it out.
Yeah, I think I'll do that. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your advice.
You betcha. Thanks, Steve. That was good questions. That happens a lot with, you know, it kind of brings us, we were kind of talking in the break about inheriting funds and talking about, you know, the taxability of gifting versus donating to charity versus those different items. And it can be kind of a pain now that the Secure Act has changed if you have large IRAs that you're leaving to your heirs that aren't your spouse.
Yeah. I think anytime in similar to Steve's situation, anytime you have a significant dollar amount that you're inheriting or you're thinking of converting or it's involved in an IRA, good to have some tax planning.
Yeah.
Get the ground rules. You know, it doesn't take much to figure out, you know, what's the sweet spot to convert, to distribute, what your plan is. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, you know, you take an hour with somebody, go down the list of information, and you can put a pretty good plan in place that can save you some taxes over the long haul.
Right. Just, yeah. don't, because a lot of folks get the inheritance and then they're not doing what Steve was doing, which was being thinking through, okay, what's the taxability of this? That's the key. So if you're out there, if you're thinking about leaving in annuity to your heirs, or you have an annuity that's going to be left behind to your heirs, or you are a beneficiary of one of those, when you inherit that annuity, there's also no step up in basis like there is in individual stocks or mutual funds. So when you take that money out as a beneficiary, it's taxable income to the extent it exceeds your basis. And the thing that people don't realize about annuities is they'll say, okay, well, mom left me, let's say hypothetically, mom left me a $500,000 annuity that has a $250,000 basis. So they say, well, that's a great inheritance. It's a lot of money. I need to take money out, but I'm going to be smart about it and only take bits out. And I'm going to try and take that first $250,000, which was the basis, out first. Unfortunately, the way that annuities work, when it's what's called last in, first out, or Kevin might know it as LIFO. And that means that every distribution from a non-qualified annuity, so the IRA is different, right? IRA money comes out, it's taxable no matter what you've invested in when it comes out. But in a non-qualified annuity, or an annuity that is not in an IRA contract or 401k or 403b, that non-qualified annuity, you have to satisfy all of the growth in terms of distributions first before they start looking at principal. So in that example I gave you, the first $250,000 that come out of that contract
is taxable.
Then once you satisfy that, the rest of it's basis and it's gravy, right? But so like you said, it behooves you if you have a sizable inheritance that has come in, or if you're planning for transferring your wealth, you know, after you pass away and you have a sizable tax deferred bucket, your IRA, you have a large IRA annuity, or you have large non-qualified annuities, it behooves you to sit down and do some tax planning with someone just to be smart about it.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't take that long. It's not that hard. So, Kevin, we were talking about some charitable donation stuff. There's a bunch of changes, right, with the tax law, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and then now I don't know if they changed a ton with the Secure Act in terms of charitable gifting, but it's come up. I've had a question a couple of times in the last couple of weeks since I've seen you about charitable contributions and what the maximum, you know, deduction is. In particular, one that intrigued me, and I had never even thought about it before, but have a client who works for a nonprofit organization, you know, and they're at 501c3, and they're always, you know, needing donations. It's the only way that they can help the people that they help. And the ministry that she works in, they're looking for, they need a building, so they need to buy a building conceivably, but they don't want to take on debt, and they have money to rehab a building, but not necessarily the amount of money to buy a building. And her thought process was, and I said, well, I don't know anybody that's just looking to donate an entire duplex, but if someone were hypothetically to donate a duplex, what's the kind of tax implications could get, you know?
So a large...
Why would that make sense for them to do it to...
Sure.
If they're feeling charitable, maybe they have a large estate, they're trying to get it out of the estate. That part aside, just
in
terms of current income.
Yeah. Well, the new tax law changes the limitations there are mainly along the lines of smaller in donations, where people are using the standard deduction mm-hmm. rather than taking a charitable donation when you're under $24,000 or $26,000.
Right.
This obviously is not that case.
Right.
People are still benefiting from donating on their Oregon itemized deductions, but most people are using the federal standard deduction now, the new higher amount. So it's not helping you per se on your federal return, but on the Oregon return. But when you have a large charitable donation in a particular year, and it's say part of an estate plan where mm-hmm. you're, you know, this is a significant donation.
Right.
There is a limit that says that you can only deduct up to half of your income for that year.
Okay.
So if you have 100,000 of adjusted gross income, and you give say 70,000 to charity, you'll be limited to 50,000. The 20,000 isn't lost; it just gets carried forward to the next year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So in that case, where we're talking about, hypothetically, I am donating or thinking about, you know, I don't want to manage this duplex anymore, and I have enough money in my estate, and my kids are going to be taken care of. I want to take some of this, and rather than giving it to charity at my death, I want to give it to charity now while I'm still alive.
Mm-hmm.
That deduction is limited to half of my adjusted gross income, but let's say I had $1 million of donated property, I could carry that forward till I satisfied that based on half of my income every year. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep. That's exactly right. And depending on the organization, that limit may be as low as 30%.
Oh, okay.
If it's not a straight up 501c3, if it's something along the lines of, they've got some different limits, but in general, that gets you in the game.
Okay.
You know, we do see that fairly often where you know, somebody has a windfall. Maybe not the whole thing is taxable, but they decide to give a nice chunk mm-hmm. to charity. A lot of times they'll exceed that 50% income limitation, and it gets carried forward. And that's not a bad thing. It's especially as a tax planner, you're looking at someone's prior year tax return, and you're looking at the carryovers, a little capital loss. Oh, $20,000 charitable contribution right. carryover. Now we're talking.
Right. And that can be huge. That's, you know, that charitable. So if you're thinking about being charitable, the significance comes when you're itemizing on the federal return, though, right? That's worth repeating.
Exactly. And, you know, if you're carrying $5,000 over to the next year and you're using the standard deduction, well, that right. may be kind of a wasted $5,000. You might want to plan that a little.
Yeah, might want to think about it. So again, I mean, I feel like we're a broken record, but it makes sense to sit down with someone and do some tax planning, do some gifting planning, if those are things that, you know, apply to you and think.
Yeah. You know, one question we get quite often mm-hmm. is, how much do I get to deduct when I donate my time? Or maybe I donate an office space,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, a tenant moved out and I decide to let a charity use it for 6 months while they're transitioning to a new place or something.
Yeah.
How much do you get to deduct for that? You know, you could have rented that office space
right.
for, you know, $2,000 a month, and you're letting someone use it for free. It seems to make sense that you
right.
get to deduct $12,000. But the answer is actually on both of these accounts, zero.
Okay.
The value of your services is zero. The value of your time is zero. The value of donated real property is zero, because how do you actually value that? First off, you know, a doctor serving.
Use of real property, not donated. Right,
right. Yeah. Use of real property. yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, you're good.
Yeah.
Just making sure I was not confused.
No. Yeah. So you know, a doctor goes to a foreign country and helps out for 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, what is his time worth versus somebody who may be teaching Sunday school?
Right.
You know, the doctor thinks he's worth $10,000 an hour. And you know, so there's no way to value that. So the answer is just zero on both of those.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, logically, you would think that you could write off your time. And yeah, sure, mm-hmm. for sure. It's like you said, it's how do we decide what your time is worth? But really, the other thing, as you were saying, that I was thinking, well, sure, I'm taking time off, and so what? But what am I deducting against, right? Because you're not earning any money while you're donating the time, so it's another. You kind of come back to that word with that deduction, right?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, that makes sense. That, you know, we're thinking about gift. So if you're thinking about gifting to, you know, to charity, that can make a lot of sense. A lot of people are charitably inclined. You mentioned something that, you know, that piqued my interest as well, is something I wanted to talk about. Is we're in 1099 season now, right? And just getting into when folks are probably getting you their tax items. And if you're wondering about your 1099, the requirement is that today it was mailed out to you. So it had to be mailed out by today from your custodian or from your bank. Remember, your banks will send you a 1099 INT for the interest that you earned. It's worth noting, if you made any changes in terms of your investment accounts, your non-qualified investment accounts, that's your, you'll hear them as an individual, your trust account, your joint account with your spouse, your UTMA account where you set up the gift to the kids account, anything like that. If you have made a change of custodian, say you moved from TD Ameritrade to Fidelity, if you've made a change of your advisor on there, say you moved from an advisor to Edward Jones over to Price Financial Group, maybe. So if you've made any sort of changes in that non-qualified account, you're going to get more than one 1099. And then the specific change that comes up that surprises people is if your account number changes, and that's because you have maybe a change of advisor. We have a lot of clients that this happened, is, you know, with Chuck's retirement, where folks are getting a changed account number as we're making a change in, and they're going to have two 1099s. And the reason is because it spent a certain amount of time in one account number, your account, and then it spent a certain amount of time in the other account, and it earned dividends, maybe some interest, while it was in that first account. So make sure you're paying attention to the amount of 1099s that you're going to get, because you don't want to have to file an amended return. I mean, it's not a big deal, but it's a pain, right? So people want to get a jump on getting their taxes done. They want to get all that stuff. I would just plead with you to make sure you have all the things together before you go ahead and file. Doesn't mean you can't start, you know, send it over to your CPA, get it there early. He'll appreciate it that he's got it early and you're not calling him on April 13th. Where's my taxes? But make sure you know what's coming. And that's, it's a hard thing to know, because, and that's why I just wanted, you know, to put it out there where you didn't know that, right? If you made a change with your investment account, or your investment advisor changed firms, or you changed firms, you moved some money from Fidelity to Vanguard, any of that sort of stuff, you're going to have multiple 1099s. So make sure you're paying attention to that, because it can kind of throw a wrench in your in your planning. So we're going to take a break here, and we'll be back with the tax investigator. Stay with us. And if you have a question, give us a call, 503-222-9700. That's 503-222-9700. You're listening to Investing Simplified.
It's Michael Standard, Regional Reverse Mortgage Specialist and Senior Mortgage Banker with Fairway's First Team Independent Mortgage Corporation. For more information on home equity conversion mortgages and traditional mortgages, please call me at 360-690-5278. Again, 360-690-5278 for a free consultation, or email me at michael.standard@fairwaymc.com. NMLS number 1674259.
Copyright 2019, Fairway Independent Mortgage Corporation, Fairway. NMLS number 2289, 4750 South Biltmore Lane, Madison, Wisconsin, 53718. 1-866-912-4800. All rights reserved. Fairway is not affiliated with any government agencies. These materials are not from HUD or FHA and were not approved by HUD or a government agency. Reverse mortgage borrowers are required to obtain an eligibility certificate by receiving counseling sessions with a HUD-approved agency. The youngest borrower must be at least 62 years old. Monthly reverse mortgage advances may affect eligibility for some other programs. This is not an offer to enter into an agreement. Not all customers will qualify. Information, rates, and programs are subject to change without notice. All products are subject to credit and property approval. Other restrictions and limitations apply. Michael Standards, Oregon and Washington, NMLS number 1674259.
Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Colson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified, and we do welcome your calls, 503-222-9700, 800-344-5836. I think those sound right. But we do have a caller, Lee, I think one of our longtime listeners is on the line. Lee, are you there?
I am. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
This is the real Kevin Stege, right? Not a Kevin bot.
This
Not
is...
The real Kevin is...
Yeah,
in his office.
I'm kind of a shell of myself, but you know, I'm here in person at least, if not in spirit.
All righty. Quick question on the 1099s. I heard from somebody that if it's less, if the interest or slash dividends is going to be less than $5 or is it $50? They don't have to issue a 1099. Is that true or no?
Yeah, it depends on the type of income that is being reported on the 1099. If it's interest and dividends, it's $10. So anything less than $10, you know, your credit union checking account makes, you know, $8.60. Chances are you aren't going to get a 1099 from them. But theoretically, you're still supposed to report it on your tax return. So anyway.
Okay, so you have to get that off an account statement or something, year-end statement or something like that.
Exactly right, yeah. Although I did get one the other day for 14 cents. And so I was like, that's a kind of a waste of paper, but hey.
Yeah. All righty. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good.
Thanks, Lee. Good question.
Yeah. Good stuff. Okay. So today on the Tax Investigator, I'm going to talk a little bit about estate and trust taxation, income taxation, and some of the differences of trusts and how they're taxed and how an estate is different from a trust. We're not going to go into a ton of detail, but for those who are interested, this is scintillating information.
Yeah, I stood up when you started talking. I was sitting down before, but
that's right. And if you can't handle this information and you do have a question, give us a call and you'll take precedence.
Yeah.
503-222-9700 and 800-344-5836. So I want to start off first off with living trust. How is a living trust taxed? Well, a living trust is considered a disregarded entity from you, the person who sets it up, or the grantor. That's also another name. Okay. So it can be called a grantor trust. It can be called a living trust.
Revocable living trust. There's a lot of different terminology. I know Taylor, when she's in here, mentions it depends on the state that you're in. It depends on the attorney that you worked with, all the different things.
That's exactly right. And it is as it sounds. It's disregarded for tax purposes. You're typically using your Social Security number with those accounts or however it's presented, and you continue to file on your personal tax return just as if it was in your name. And there is a scenario or two where a grantor trust can file a shell of a 1041, but we won't go down those unique scenarios.
Right. The revocable trust is more an estate planning vehicle rather than a tax planning vehicle, right? It's
well
still
said.
Your money. It's still all the stuff. It's just in the title of the trust to help make the transition from you to your heirs easier.
That's right. Yeah. Exactly right. The next type of trust, irrevocable trust. Brought up
revocable,
and some people say revocable, irrevocable trust.
Ooh, I like that.
Yes, and this is typically you're putting money into the trust. It's going out of your estate.
The gift to the trust,
exactly,
right?
And the beneficiary whoever is the beneficiary of that trust very may well be getting a gift from you. So there is a gift tax implications to funding an irrevocable trust, and that is its own separate entity, and typically it's going to have to file a tax return if it has enough income during the year. A lot of when you're living trust, when you die and it's no longer a living trust, it becomes typically an
irrevocable trust
at that time. And so it becomes its own entity, typically needs its own tax ID number, and it goes forward under the terms of the trust document. And typically you have a successor trustee that is in place because you're the trustee before and now you're dead, so the successor trustee steps in. Trusts are typically going to report the exact same income that an individual is going to report. If you have an IRA distribution in a trust, it's going to be taxable just like as if you took it out on your own. Interest, dividends, capital gains, rents, business income, all of that gets reported. Deductions are mostly the same. One interesting thing is there is not a cap, a $10,000 cap on state and local taxes.
Interesting. In an irrevocable trust. So having the property in there, you get to write off more than just the $10,000 on state and local taxes.
Yep. But there is a scenario, and they call it trapping deductions, where you may not have enough income generating assets in a trust, and you have more expenses. And so say you have property that is paying that has
property tax.
Exactly. Real estate taxes of $6,000, and you're only generating about, $3,000 of interest and dividends from a brokerage account. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're wasting $3,000 of deductions.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure you consider that when trusts are being funded, have enough income to utilize the deductions, or maybe keep the deductions on the other side of things outside of the trust.
And is there a standard deduction for a trust? You said mostly the same deductions, so no standard deduction for a trust.
Nope. And I say mostly because there are a few different deductions, additional deductions, attorney, accountant, fiduciary fees, the trustee fees.
Sure.
You get to take a few of those extra things that, some admin costs that, you and I don't get to take on our taxes personally. So a few other things there. And then, of course, there is the scenario where, say, after you got your income on there, you've got your expenses, and there's $20,000 of taxable income in your trust.
Okay.
And everyone knows, we've talked about it a lot, mm-hmm. trusts have a compressed tax bracket. You're in the 37% bracket when you hit $13,000, roughly.
That's like state of Oregon, except for a much higher rate.
Exactly. So it's exactly right. And so you typically don't want income taxed in the trust. So there's this thing called an income distribution deduction, and that's when you've got $20,000 of taxable income. If you cut a check to the beneficiary or wherever the trust says that income is supposed to go, the income beneficiary, the trust takes a $20,000 deduction, has zero taxable income now, and then a K-1 reports $20,000 to that income beneficiary, and they report it on their tax return.
Sure, sure.
To hopefully use...
to not be in the 37% bracket, hopefully.
And uses their own deductions and tax planning and stuff. So that's typically how a trust is going to work. A trust has to be calendar year end.
Okay.
And you don't, and the reason I bring that up is because now we're going to talk about estates. And maybe, should we go to break and talk about estates just briefly afterwards?
Sure. That's fine. Yeah, that's a good idea. That's for those of you who don't know in the business, that's called a tease.
Okay.
So we'll tease that. We'll finish talking about it because I want to talk about estates, and I think it'll lead us into some discussion on how to maybe minimize maybe what you're paying in the estate possibly. But if you have a question specifically about your situation, if, like Lee, you have a question about 1099s, give us a call, 503-222-9700. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com. 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. I know you've been waiting with bated breath to hear about the estate tax changes, the difference between, we've been talking about how revocable trusts are taxed. They're taxed like a normal person. It's passed through just kind of, I'm not recapping for everyone in the audience either. I'm recapping for myself, too, just making sure that I followed what was going on. An irrevocable trust, whether that's established at your death or whether you've established an irrevocable trust as an estate planning technique or a gifting technique, that's taxed at the trust level, which can be severely compressed, or you can get really high tax brackets really fast unless the income is distributed to an income beneficiary, in which case that trust gets to deduct that income. Whereas you and I can't just deduct that income by giving it to a beneficiary. I can't just send it to my wife and deduct it, right? That's not a thing?
No, it's got to be part of the trust document.
Nuts.
Yep.
All right.
Exactly.
Well, but so then how does an estate work when we're talking about estate taxes?
So then basically with an estate, we've got an estate entity is created when you have any asset that is not in a living trust or does not have a direct beneficiary or a TOD associated with the account. Direct beneficiary being like an IRA. Mm-hmm, that's going to go directly to them immediately. A TOD, a transfer on death deed for real estate, that's got to do its thing. Mm-hmm. And then it's typically going to go directly to the beneficiary. Maybe some attorneys would say that needs to quasi, but there's typically not a lot of expenses or income associated with that. Anything that's probated is mm-hmm. certainly going to be part of somebody's estate income tax return from the date that they die. And an estate is very simple, uses the same form as a trust, a 1041, but there's a few key differences. The first difference is we have a fiscal year end option.
Okay.
And this is actually one of the biggest tax planning tools that we use for estates. And you think, well, it's not such a big deal. But number one, so say somebody passes away in October of 2019, we can choose a fiscal year in any month in all the way up to September 30th of 2020. Any month that we choose that's in 2020 as our year end is actually going to pass that income out in 2020 to the beneficiary. So that gives us a lot of, number one, it delays income typically even almost up to a year, and it gives us a lot of option to flexibility when estates are administered. Things aren't always just ratably over every single month. Big events happen all of a sudden at once, bunch of distributions. You want to make sure in your reporting period that, you know, potentially you can just do a first and a final if you choose the right fiscal year end. So that's pretty significant. Estates do have a deduction that trusts don't, and it's called preservation of estate assets.
Interesting.
Deduction.
I would assume that's something along the lines of you have to keeping up a building or expenses that go along with that or something like that?
That's exactly right. Putting items in storage. Things to, you know, there's many different forms that preservation of estate asset deduction can take. And that's an additional deduction that's allowed to the estate. And estate has a little bit higher threshold for having to file. It has, again, the fiscal year end. So almost always when a person has a living trust and they pass away, and say you have a scenario, they have assets in a trust, but a couple assets didn't make it in the trust and they have to be probated. So now you have a trust tax return and an estate tax return. Well, there's an option to combine those, and it's called a 645 election. It's basically, it lets the trust be taxed like an estate, folds all the assets into one return, and you go for it. Best left to the tax professionals.
Yeah, right. If you're doing this, so what you're saying is I can just go on to TurboTax and just Google 645. Yeah, definitely want to be working with. So if you have an estate planning question, give Kevin's office a call. Drop him an email. Right. Make sure you come in and set an appointment to go over that sort of stuff.
Exactly right.
Because you know, it can be a really big deal, right? So what I heard you mention a couple times. So, and it's worth mentioning. I wish Taylor was here because she could speak more to it than we can. But other than if that's a big question that I know she gets a lot, we get a lot when people are asking, you know, we're asking about their estate planning that they've done. Say, hey, do I need to go see an attorney? Do I need a trust? Right? And that's a hard question for me to answer because I'm not an estate planning attorney. This question that Taylor can answer. But if you think about it, you know, you may not think you need a trust and you may not. You know, that's why you give her office a call and they'll tell you know, they'll shoot you straight. But if anything that's in your will goes through probate, which is what you're just mentioning. So you're going to have that estate processing, which may get spread out over time, particularly if you have real property, if most of your estate is in your home or something like that, right?
Yep.
And that's not to say that estate tax, we're not talking about the estate tax filing for your gross estate. You were just mentioning, so he's just mentioning the income
tax,
right? Because your estate can earn income, and a lot of people don't realize that.
Yep, and not the inheritance tax.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah. And, you know, this is just a very short surface level discussion. Yeah. It's one of the more complicated areas, and it's not cheap when you use a tax professional who knows what they're doing. However, if you look at the IRS forms at the very back of the instructions, and they give you like estimated time to prepare, learn about the law, do record keeping and stuff, typically we're talking hundreds of hours that they're saying is going to take somebody to properly file one of these. So other than the record keeping, it's definitely worth paying somebody who can keep you on the straight and narrow. You know, it's not cheap, but it's usually only a year or two.
Right.
So,
you know, it's worth getting done, but that's, if you're thinking about it, that's how you're thinking, oh, oof, that sounds like a lot of things. You maybe have that conversation with your spouse, have that conversation with your parents, have a conversation with your kids about getting started with the pre-planning now. Because if you can meet with a tax professional, you meet with an estate attorney, you can go over a lot of that stuff and make sure that the road is clear and it's a lot smoother for either yourself if you're inheriting money from your parents or from a spouse that you have to process the estate, or make it smoother for your kids or your grandkids, your beneficiaries, whoever you're leaving the funds to.
Yep, that's right.
One of the things that, you know, that happens a lot, you know, that people talk about a lot this year too, when we're talking about RMDs, we're talking about charitable deductions. We have a longtime listener, Henry, who calls and he does the qualified charitable distribution, right? The QCD from his IRA. And a lot of people think about that in his situation, which it was his situation of, yeah, he's got an RMD he's got to take out, right? Because he's over 70 and a half, and he sends his qualified charitable distribution direct to the charity. You don't have to write it off. There's nothing to write off because there was no income realized. But what a lot of people don't realize, if you're over 59 and a half, you can do that qualified charitable distribution now. And if you're someone who's charitably inclined, especially with this new tax law changes where your heirs are going to have to spend that money. Like I think with Steve was the first caller, you know, that inherited the money. They're going to have to spend that money over 10 years. So instead of maybe gifting, if you're tithing at church, if you just pledge, you know, that's where a lot of folks do it, is at their church or at their place of worship, or if you have a specific cause that you've been giving money to every year, consider doing a qualified charitable distribution from your IRA and keeping that money, that saving that money that you would have given to them and investing it the same way you would have in the IRA or investing it however, but building up that non-qualified asset so it's not 100% taxable when you leave it to your heirs. If you have a sizable IRA, that can be a real tax headache for the people that you're trying to set up. You're saving all this money. You worked really hard your whole life and saved money, and the plan was to leave it to your kids, get them set up. And wouldn't it be nice if there was a better way to get them set up with a little less tax that they might owe? So that's a planning option. Like you said, it's worth meeting with someone. You can, if you have a large IRA, you've been thinking about, I want to leave this to my kids, you're not needing it, and you want to talk through some scenarios. A qualified charitable distribution is not right for everybody. Maybe you're not charitably inclined. I don't know. Yep. But there's a lot of different options that people don't know about, so it's worth meeting with an advisor. You can give my office a call, like I said, 503-253-3000. You can send me an email, bo@pfgwm.com. You can call Kevin. We work in the same areas depending on, you know, we cover different portions of your planning aspects, you know, but there's a lot of things that you don't know. Chuck's adage was, what you don't know can hurt you, right? A lot of different ways that you can avoid paying more tax than you need to. Mm-hmm.
The closest thing to a sure thing in tax planning is this scenario. You're subject to RMDs, you're charitably inclined, and you take the standard deduction. The qualified charitable distribution is a no-brainer, because if you don't do the QCD, you're basically having to report the income, and donating to charity doesn't help you because you're taking the standard deduction. Doing the QCD keeps that income off of your tax return.
Yeah.
So you gotta, if you meet those three things, you're taking an RMD, you're charitably inclined, and you're taking the standard deduction, consider the QCD.
Right. Well, because there's no reason not to use it, right?
That's right.
You're giving the deduction. If you're taking the standard deduction, if you're not itemizing, you get no benefit tax-wise from giving to charity. You're charitably inclined, you're getting a benefit from giving to charity. The charity's getting a benefit. Why not make it tax smart? Utilize the QCD, right?
That's right.
Qualified Charitable Distribution is what that stands for. So, Kevin, if people have questions about the QCD, whether it's right to make that plan or if they want to do some advanced tax planning, how do they get a hold of you?
We are at 503-666-5569, and our website is baker-colson.com.
And if you want to get a hold of me, come see us, 503-253-3000. We have offices both the east side and west side of Portland to better serve you. We're happy to meet with you. Give us a call. Like I said, the first hour is on us. If you need Taylor's information or Michael Standard's information, the folks who come on the show, feel free to give my office a call. We'll give that to you. No problem. Thank you for listening. Thanks for tuning in this week. We'll be back with another scintillating week of Investing Simplified next week. God bless y'all. Have a great day out there.
Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security seminar on demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000. You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show was brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated.